Hello, friends. This is Amy Stewart.
And I'm Adam Benson.
And this is On Call.
Stories and conversations on calling.
Today we are joined by Stephen Lewis. The Reverend Stephen Lewis is the president of the Forum for Theological Exploration, which is based in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a native of Charlotte, North Carolina, and a graduate of UNC Charlotte and Duke Divinity School. Stephen is also the creator and co-founder of Do Good X, a startup accelerator for diverse Christian social entrepreneurs. He is an organizational change strategist and a leadership developmentalist focused on inspiring the next generation of faithful, faith-inspired leaders and entrepreneurs to live and work on purpose. Stephen is the co-author of Another Way, Living and Leading Change on Purpose, and A Way Out of No Way, An Approach to Christian Innovation. We look forward to sharing this conversation on calling with you today. Friends, welcome back to another episode of On Call. We're here today with Stephen Lewis. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
Our first question is around your own experience of discerning a call. As you think back, some of your earliest memories around the work of discernment and sensing a call to ministry, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, you know, when I think about discerning a call to ministry, I think about unpacking that word ministry, right? So it comes from, you know, the same root word of service and the ways in which we're called to serve with our life in the communities that we're a part of, in the relationships that, you know, that we get to journey with and through in life. And so in many ways, I think we're constantly in a perpetual journey of unfolding and disclosure that requires us to constantly be in discernment. So then when I think about discerning, my earliest experiences, of course, I think, you know, in this particular context is really in a congregation. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, went to Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. And it was a place for, you know, middle class African-Americans, or at least those who are kind of, you know, kind of moving in that direction. It was a place to go. You know, the mayor of the city at that time, Harvey Gantt, went there and, you know, a lot of people. So it was kind of a professional church in that regards. But I remember it really was a place that really shaped and supported young people and young leaders like myself. And I remember my Sunday school teachers saying to me, you ask some really profound questions. You ask a lot of questions. It sounds like, you know, you need to be somewhere that can help you formulate those kinds of questions. And I remember, you know, God bless her soul, there was a lay elder in our congregation. Her name was Mother Pearson, Mary Pearson. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the church, she would say, come here, son. God has God's hand on you. And she would look at me with, you know, her intent eyes. And, you know, she was dressed to the nine. You know, she couldn't be no more than 5'5", 5'3". And, you know, I could feel her wise age hands grabbing my hand and says, keep your hand in God's hand. God is working with you. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, those are the moments where the community like her or my Sunday school teacher or Bible school teacher would say, God is up to something in, you know, in Stephen. And it was those moments that I think drew my attention to what is it people are saying about me? You know, like not even, I think, cognizant or aware that something was happening within me in that regard. And so I do think, you know, it is a larger community they help me to sense a greater awareness that God is calling me. And I think, in the African American kind of vernacular, this idea, this theological, philosophical concept of Ubuntu, I am because we are, really reinforces this idea that you can't understand yourself outside of community. And kind of in a Western rugged individualism that we find in the US context, it's like, how's God calling you? Well, the corrective is how is God calling the community, and what is my role in the community, and beyond the community, to partner and conspire with what God is up to within the larger concentric circles of communities that we find ourselves in our states, in our cities, and within the broader world. But I can only understand myself in relationship to other people. Who I am and what I'm becoming, I only know that in relationship to other people. And I think it's that larger community that at least trying to maybe even stumble and maybe even don't do it well is the way in which they are kind of trying to discern what God is up to, that then I can then they can at least put a mirror up to myself and say, hey, as a people who are called out, the ecclesia, the church, we also recognize how God is calling you out uniquely and distinctively within this community to give back. So that would be one experience. Another experience is that, I worked in corporate America, and part of what I, before entering to seminary, right out of college, and I was doing like lunchtime Bible studies, talking to people, on the street, all this type of stuff. And, I had people, coming to me and talking to me. And I think people recognize, like, okay, this person I just kind of studied. So it's like this person actually really has something going on. And I think it was really, again, even in that corporate setting, I had people identifying, recognizing gifts that I was slowly becoming aware of in that sense. But those would be kind of my earliest memories of thinking about that and realizing that, you know what? My life has to have greater significance than climbing the corporate ladder, making a lot of money, finding somebody to settle down with, having children, having a nice home, growing old and die. I have to believe that my life has greater significance than that. And I believe that, everybody's lives have greater significance than just the vocations that we set out to do, whether it's what we want to do professionally or what it is that we call to be and do. I think it really is an invitation to conspire with the eternal, to do something that's greater beyond ourselves.
I like your phrasing of that, conspiring with the eternal. And as a president of the Forum for Theological Exploration, you probably get to see a lot of glimpses or images or hear some stories from different communities about what God is up to in different communities in and around Atlanta, but probably outside of Georgia. And would you be willing to share a couple of examples of how you've seen what God is up to in a community? We're always kind of talking about in this season of church institutional member decline, in a season of political division, unrest, climate change, all of these big issues that are happening, kind of what God is up to in the season that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting question that you raise. I think some of it is still yet to unfold, and a lot of what God is up to is the meaning making that we make in our lives. And what I mean by that, different communities are wrestling with how they make meaning of their lives, how they make meaning of the moment and the relationship, and we're always negotiating whose meaning is more valuable or less valuable when it comes to being aligned with what we understand our faith to be or not to be. In many ways, I may even, get in trouble for saying this, but, God, the word God, is a construction of us. we're making meaning of how we understand our relationship to the eternal. And that then becomes, that's a Germanic term that gets translated into this thing that we call God or whatever. And so in many ways, we are constructing God or making meaning of this construction that we've made. And I know that's maybe kind of go off on an academic sense of thing, but what I'm saying is that we are made in the image, and we're also making God and making meaning of God in our lives. And that is what it means to be meaning-making beings. And so in that regards, what I think what we see, or at least some of what I see, is people who are trying to make meaning of a God who is still interested in tall steeple churches and in traditional ways in which we have been, because God has called the church and called the church in a particular expression of how we understand and make meaning of that expression, because that expression is important to us. Well, we have a new generation of folks and saying, well, I see God who is interested in what's taking place in my broader community beyond the bricks and mortar of my parents' institution. How does God speak to the issue of climate change? How does God speak to the issue of these things as it relates to how I care for myself, have shelter, have clothing, make sure the least among us are fed and resourced and have housing? Like, God is there. And so you had this clashing of our understanding of God because of our constructions and our constructions of God and what we discern what God cares about. And so what I see is that it's not an either or, it's a both and. And what I think, what I sense, to the extent I can even have the audacity to even begin to formulate in out of my mouth what God is up to, is arrogant in itself, right? We see it in the story of Job. Why God has brought this calamity upon me? And then it's only later in, in the later parts of that chapter, you see God comes out, in this narrative and say, Job, were you here when? Job, were you there when? How can you even begin to understand the mind of God, and let alone what God is up to? And that is the human struggle, wrestling with this idea of, I know there's something greater than us. I'm part of a great tradition that has storied and wrestled with these ideas of God. What is God up to in our lives now? And the vast majority, the best of what we can say, we can talk about that God is still calling people to ministry. Is that all that God is doing? So I think part of what we see is, depending on where you stand, your community, your tradition, but from where I sit, God is still concerned about the least among us. And you know what? We are the hands and the feet and the heart of God in our respective communities. We can bless people or curse people. And part of it is like, what are we going to do? Is God interested in our buildings? Is God really interested in our, denominational entities that we've created to maintain these traditions? Is God interested in these things? I think the writers of scripture would say that, God trusts us, these earthen vessels. So how might we be more caring and considerate and interested in these earthen vessels, particularly those that are cracked and considered to be undervalued, under-resourced, invisible to this economic progress that we see taking place across the globe and even in our country? I think, God is with young people who are finding ways to build community online and on TikTok and all these types of places. God is still, at bedsides of people who are infirmed and who need help and support. God is still with people who feel like that God has abandoned them and doesn't care anything about those who find, people who are slain, at the hand of violence and school violence or whatever. God is in all those things, but God, it's not some abstract thing outside of us, beyond us. God is embodied in flesh within us and how we act in the world. That's what's at the center of our story. That the word is in flesh, not just in the person of Jesus, but he's enfleshed in all of us as the body of Jesus or Christ and the ways in which we act and interact in the world. So those are just some of the things that I would say that, that young people care about a faith that is active and engaged within their communities. And our seniors and elders are interested in a God who is active in their respective institutions and community and is caring for them as they continue to age in life and to know that, that they have something that they can contribute and give back. If not to a broader community, to the people that come in a part of their respective institutions. And I don't think there's an either or. I think it's a both and. And so that's what I would offer from that point of view.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you. I like that we can't, because it's true, we can't know God or understand God or accept God outside of us being embodied spiritual beings that are on the ground in our own particular communities that have their own set of issues. And we can't separate. I like that corrective from how God may be calling us from the ways that we imagine God in our own minds, and then the ways that God has always been present and for the marginalized communities, and just how that manifests in your own communities. I like that. We were wondering, exploring if a calling in the ministry presumes a kind of mysticism or a level of spiritual awareness to hear a call from God, even if it's aided through or delivered through other people in a community. And I just wondered if you'd offer some thoughts or reflections on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, a calling also assumes a hearing, someone who can hear, or at least be aware that they're being called. I know, once upon a time there used to be a time, make sure you're home by dark. And one thing you didn't want to hear is your mom, or is your mother, or your father, or your caretaker calling your name in the streets, Stephen. So it's requires, someone who's doing a calling, but also someone's doing the hearing, or at least being aware that they have been called. And I love what the legendary educator and mystic Howard Thurman shared in his, there's a popularized piece that gets shared from his 1980 baccalaureate address to Spelman College, to women who are graduating, college graduates. But he says, he talks about this idea of the sound of the gene, that there is in you, in each of us, something that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine within ourselves. And he goes on to say, no one like you has ever been born. You are the only one. And if you cannot hear the sound of the gene within yourself, it is better that you had never been born. And then he says, he repeats this again. He says, if you hear the sound of the gene you don't follow, you will forever be on the ends of strings that someone else pulls. So this idea of calling is one thing. What's more important is hearing. And not hearing outside of yourself, but hearing in the deeps of yourself. Or the psalmist who says, deep that calleth unto deep. My question is, where do we turn to build the capacity to cultivate our own intuition, to cult our capacity to listen to the sound of a caller that is within us. I mean, the writer of Isaiah talks about how the Lord called me from the womb of the body of my mother. You see Jeremiah who says, in the opening chapters, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. That God actually knows us even before conception. And not just aware of us, but knows us. And that before we was born, that God, at least in Jeremiah's case, consecrated, appointed Jeremiah. This whole idea that our lives have purpose. We're not here haphazardly. We're not here just because of our parents' love or lust in some manner. In spite of those things, that at least we are part of a rich scriptural wisdom tradition that suggests just maybe that one, God knew us before we even came here, and two, that our lives have purpose. Our lives have greater significance than just what do you want to be when you grow up? That we come here with something and we've been consecrated and appointed. And so part of the question is like, how can you listen to yourself to hear within yourself the voice of the genuine, the voice of the caller, the voice of one who is summoning you to use your life to bless others in the world? I think, yeah, so it requires, I think, whether you want to call it mysticism or if you want to call it, spiritual awareness, I do think it does require us to pay attention to our inner life, our inner world. But more importantly, how do we build our capacity to listen? In the words of Thurman, can you get still enough? Not quiet enough, but still enough. Even in the busyness of life, can you get still enough in the, in the noisy, as Thurman would talk about, in the noisy streets within your mind that are rioting in your streets, can you get still enough to hear the unique rumbling inside yourself? I don't know if you can, but he says this is our assignment. So where do we turn to? Who are our teachers? Where are our religious spaces that do more than just teach us to pray, but help us to cultivate our ability to hear and listen to the voice of God? Eli tells Samuel, I'm not call I didn't call you. Go back and listen. Who teaches us? What is it? What does that even mean to listen to our, listen to our inner life, listen to our insides? Like, where do you go to learn that? Is there a degree in that? Are there masters in that? Is there a theological trick? Like, who teaches us to listen, not pray, but to listen for the voice? And how do you distinguish the sound of the genuine, the sound of the holy, the eternal voice from your own inner conversations in your mind or ego? How do you distinguish that? I think that's what's at the crux of this idea of discernment. How do you know that you've heard, you're making the right decision? How do you know? Well, it's by faith. Okay, well, substance of things hoped for, evidence of things not seen. Yes, but how do you know that you've heard? How do you get quiet enough to hear, to sense, to feel the presence? So this idea of calling, I think we understand the caller. There's a caller, of course, but the bigger task for us, and I think in the church, is how do we build the capacity for people to listen, to hear, to sense, and to cultivate their intuitive faculties to be able to hear the ways that they may be called. And non-domesticated, non-colonizing, non-expansive, or imaginatively impoverished ways.
Well, I'm curious just to kind of follow that thread, if the first steps to listening is just to try, is just to be still long enough and try to listen and stumble and fall a few times before you try it. And I'm struck by, I don't know what church traditions that you grew up in, but in the ones that I grew up in, they weren't very comfortable with silence. It's amazing that you go into a worship service or in Sunday school in the churches that I grew up in, and people are afraid to be silent. Isn't that amazing that you can just be in a church tradition that doesn't know what to do with silence? And there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. And I don't think it's about a monastic life. I mean, I think you can hear God in the busyness of life if you can steel yourself. Even if you're in a crowded arena, can you steel yourself to listen inward or to point your attention inward versus outward to hear what's going on inside of you? Like, do we even have like the emotional intelligence to be aware of how we're feeling in any given moment? Or are we cut off at the neck? And it's kind of what I'm thinking, what I'm conceptualizing, whatever, but like, no, what? What are you intuiting? What are you feeling? And so, yeah, I think you have church traditions that are like that, that are not comfortable with silence. But I also want to suggest that this is not just about being quiet. It's about quieting your inner life in the midst of in the midst of a busy life to be able to hear. You know, I just interviewed a gentleman last week, Victor Koo, who started basically the equivalent of YouTube in China. And he's gone on to now do all this work around thinking about the inner life and contemplative life for entrepreneurs. And he said, you know, I meditate for 2.5 hours a day. This is not a monk. This is not even a religious professional. He's talking about he meditates 2 hours. And so why do you do that? He says, because what it does is it helps me clear my mind, but also, you know what? I may be working really hard on a particular problem, and it's only in that moment of like spaciousness that I actually are begin to hear possible alternatives to the problems that I'm working with in terms of solutions. And he's not the first. I've talked to many other people who do this, who have some type of contemplative practice or mindfulness practice or whatever you want to call it, but the point is, I just really want to say, whether you're in a quiet space or a busy space, the bigger question is, can you quiet your inner life and pay attention to what's going on with inside you and to discern, is this me and my emotions speaking to me? And sometimes those emotions are sometimes they can be guides or whatever. Is this my mind? How do you steel yourself, even in the busyness of life, to be able to discern? And I think that's important because most of us are not going to live a monastic life. Most of us are not going to go, and go somewhere off and like that's not realistic for the vast majority. We got family, we have kids, or we have jobs and other things that are constantly vying for our attention. And the question is that in the midst of all those things vying for us, can we get still enough? Not quiet enough, but still enough to hear the unique rumbling of our own voice. With the psalmist in 130 said, "Oh Lord, you have searched me and known me. You're acquainted with all my ways." Like, even in the business of our lives, how do we pay attention to the one who is searching us and acquainted with us and calling us and knew us and says, hey, you know what? There's more that you want to do. And I think, perhaps Adam is, most of us may not be interested in doing that. Because to do that, you might like, man, I knew I shouldn't have done this. Because now, like, I'm being called to move across, uproot my family. And, like, I'm not trying to do all that. I'm going to put constraints. If you want me, you get me on Sunday, Wednesday night, or whatever. You know what I'm saying? So I think, it's really scary to avail yourself to get still enough.
Yeah, it was Meister Eckhart, I think, who said that the spiritual life or growth for him was less addition and more about subtraction. What do you need to
Yes.
subtract in order to hear? Yeah, and some of us may not want to know what's down there or what it will cost
That's right.
to find out.
That's right. That's right.
Well, and as you were talking, it was reminding me, this was 8 years ago, maybe. Somebody was saying, he's a the lead of the church planting group. I have a coach and a therapist and a spiritual director, so we all all these people that are helping us to learn how to sit still and to listen. And you mentioned emotional intelligence. There are so many different self-exploratory tools. We know our Enneagram and our strengths and da 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 da. So as much as we all are examining ourselves and our inner thoughts, the people that I sense who really are still, you named Mama Pearson, she probably was just really well experienced with just being. And it's a gift when you come across someone who is just able to just sort of be and not a frenetic. I'm trying to listen. I have an appointment with my coach, and then and the people that can just exude that kind of calmness, I think, is really what you're getting at. So you have a very interesting vantage point, serving with the Forum for Theological Exploration, and I've learned you do a lot of planting of seeds of different projects and investing in leaders and bringing in young people and hearing their thoughts and what they're considering. I'm curious how you've seen the work of discernment, look, learning to listen, learning to hear, learning to talk, what you've observed over your time with that position and through the encounters you've had with various individuals from various denominations and experiences. How have you seen this work evolve over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, earlier it was really about people, particularly young leaders, being awakened to the call. There were pastors who would, dynamic pastors who would, encourage young people to listen to God's call in their lives. And so that was very kind of a, an individual kind of one-on-one type of relationship or dynamic in terms of the ways in which some of that work I would see unfold. And then I would see, more of that work then move to like calling congregations, like congregations that communities who nurture call. So not an individual pastor, but it is the work of the community to do this. So we believe in the priesthood of all believers. Well, all believers have a role in doing that. And again, understanding the language and the root even of the word of the church, ecclesia, those that are called out, that are called to call other people out to partner with God in that. And so you see, congregations at least trying to figure out how they do this work of nurturing callings, not just pastors, but all believers. And then, I think that then, what we started to see, in our work was people who either exemplified a culture of call, or how do you create cultures of calling that then really get into like discrete practices of vocational accompaniment. So that's some of what I've seen through the years. We was kind of looking at a typology earlier on. It would be like, pastors who kind of understood our work and they were committed to working on call. And then, we had pastors who had never thought about nurturing call. That's between them and God. And then when they came in contact with our work, they was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we should be doing that. And then you had pastors who support young people with a call only if they've tried to explore other vocational opportunities and they just could not escape not doing this work. And then you had that fourth type of pastor who said they would never encourage a young person to call to ministry because of either their experience or they we caught them on the wrong day, were they being burnt out or something like that. But then as we started to move from individual pastors, what we saw, and when we started looking at the life of communities, we saw that, these were communities where they were congregations or networks of congregations or some denominational representation. These were self-conscious, intentional communities that had resources, imagination, have made some decision to build an infrastructure to nurture call with and among young people. That second type of community we would see is like kind of intergenerational communities that was situated in a college town or a seminary, and they work with and they mentor college students. So those were, what we saw in terms of really nurturing that. And then the third type of, community would be kind of congregations that had a long-standing history of calling pastors. We know churches that do this work sometimes, by osmosis. They don't even really understand how they do it, but it just happens. But they call strong pastors that who then turn around and call others into ministry. And then the fourth type of congregational that I or community that I would say that we see are kind of single generational congregations, campus ministries, or college related organizations that really are intentional about attracting young people, urban and young professionals to what it is that they're doing. And they always have some hand in the church, or they've, they're shifting and discerning their own kind of career options and say, you know what, man, I had this campus minister, I had this, chaplain or this church related organization like Young Life or one of these other things. I think I might want to try my hand in that. And so that's what we see, this kind of moving from kind of individuals to communities. And it plays out in a variety of different ways in different settings because different ministry contexts are, range in terms of their diversity. And but those are kind of what I would name in terms of what I've seen through the years.
In terms of, what advice you might offer younger people who are in a season of discernment, who are beginning to ask some of those questions, how do I distinguish between just something that I want to do versus what I might be called to do? You've touched on some things already. You've touched on communities, you've touched on mentors, you've touched on listening and finding out, doing that hard work, learning how to listen to the genuine in ourselves. But if there's a young person listening in on this call who's maybe asking some practical questions, are there any action steps I can do? Or is it really about sitting back and kind of listening? What are those maybe practical things I can try to do? What might you offer to them?
And the first thing that comes to mind makes me thinking about the late poet Mary Oliver. It says, "What will you do with your one wild precious life?" Right? And I think it's about asking a young person, a young leader, to explore that question and to realize that, for the moment, in the words of another poet, Rilke, just live into the question. Just live into the question. And maybe one day, as you live in the question, you will come to realize, you will lean into and discover the answer for your life. But I think it's exploring that. I think it's about shifting from what you want to be to really what have you come to be and do. If you work from that point of view, you say, "Oh, I've already came here. I already have a sacred contract with the eternal." So the question is, what's in your contract? Why did you come? Why are you here? What are your gifts? And how are you called to use those gifts for good? The late Swiss psychiatrist Carl Gustav Jung says, I remember, writing something he read where he said, "I feel very strongly that I'm under the influence of questions that were left incomplete and unanswered by my parent and my grandparents, and even the more distant ancestors. And so this whole idea of like, why am I here? He says it's always seemed to him that he had to answer the questions that fate had posed to his foreparents, or that he had to finish or continue things which previous ages had left unfinished, which is to suggest that why you're here is not some individualistic trip, that you're part of a larger chain or legacy of those who come before you and those who come after you. The great cloud of witness that have come before you, they're cheering you on, and the great cloud of witness that have yet to come, that's cheering you to kind of live more fully into what it is that you're doing. And I think, you know, in kind of African American context and some, you know, culture, there's this idea of believing that every child came here with a purpose, a gift for the community. You remember the story in Luke 2 where Samuel, you know, is in the temple and Jesus is being consecrated. He says, ah, you know, and he says, you know, now the Lord has blessed me. And he says, but this child is a sign for your attack into, you know, in the sign for Israel. And what if every community, when we do baby baptisms or baby blessings, but depending on your tradition, had that kind of expectation that when that child is born and that child is brought to the community to be dedicated or baptized, that the community is sitting in anticipation, Advent, if you will, in some regards. Like, what is to come? Why is this child coming into our community? Why are we blessed? What has God endowed that child with? And what is our responsibility to help and to listen deeply for the purpose and the gifting that this child brings into our community? So if you had that kind of sensibility that, no, this ain't about what you want to do with your life. This is what you have already come. A purpose already in your backpack. And now you need to open it up and discover how you are to use those things. Then I think it is about you need variety of experiences to explore and questions to try on and to open up your backpack and to start making sense of these experiences. It's about listening deeply for the purpose that is within you and the gifts that you bring. But it's also like building your intuitive capacity to listen to the sound of the genuine that is within yourself. So there's this whole idea of like you or hopefully someone helps design experiences for you to listen and to experience in a variety of different settings. What to try on different things to see how does it fit on you and to make sense of that and then to be able to reflect on that. It is about being present to your emotional and your spiritual intelligence. What's taking place within you, what's taking place outside of you, and what's taking place between you and other people. I think it's about making meaning of those experiences to explore. And it's also about how do you think about the community biography and the autobiography that you are storing about yourself and reflecting on your story. And reflecting on your story, I think it's like looking at the personal social dimensions of your life. How your faith, your tradition, your history have shaped your understanding of the world, and what you might be called to do in light of that, or the dissonance that it creates as a result of that reflection. And what is it that you're agitated about? And say, okay, why am I agitated? And that may be some clues that you may need to pay attention to. But reflection on your story is also about drawing on multiple ways of knowing. So, how do you engage the feelings, your bodily sensations, non-rational modes of knowing, such as dreams and meditations and visions and your own intuition as landmarkers for understanding what is this purpose that's uncovering? It's praying for this purpose to unfold out of you. And then I think it's also, you know, reflecting on your story is about reckoning with the impacts of system and power and privilege on your own self-understanding, your understanding of communities that you're a part of or not, your relationship to the sacred, and your own agency that you get to create your one precious life. And so I think, from there, then it's about how do you get to a place where you can dream? Like, we need more places to be dream incubation. Who incubates your dreams? What are you dreaming? What are you imagining? How do you help cultivate your imagination of possibilities that before you, given your own circumstances, your own context, your own background, and your own interests? And then I think in the end, it's about you really being. Maybe it's not a scientist in the traditional sense, but it's a social scientist of experimentation. So how do you begin to experiment? This is where my curiosity leads me. This is where my ahas lead me. These are where my questions. What's one step that I could take in order to experiment with this idea, to experiment with this opportunity, and see what it uncovers for me? But to do that in community with other people who are wrestling with similar questions, or a community that will hold you and help you see what you cannot see. But those are just some of the things that I think are important. Because sometimes, we have to get out of our own social location context, because sometimes, a prophet, a leader, a teacher, a servant is not without honor within their own homes or communities. And so sometimes we need to find other communities and spaces that can help us see or create dissonance within us to help us see what we cannot always see within ourselves because of the way we've been shaped and formed.
Yeah, amen.
Homecoming service this past weekend, 68 homecoming, and they invited me to come. My prior engagement with the conference was with calling of pastors. And the pastor, it was really fascinating. At the end, she said, in 68 years, this church might still be here. And do you believe that the person who is going to be the pastor here 68 years from now has already been identified by God? Something to that. And I thought, wow, I hadn't even, what does that call the church to continue to do for the next 68 years if they're preparing for that continued line? So yeah, your words have been super impactful. Yeah, thank you for being with us. This was really great.
Yeah, you are somebody who has thought about these things a lot and deeply. And we appreciate your voice in encouraging us to think deeply and to listen to the genuine within us. And we're grateful for the way that you've heard and listened to your call so that you can help others listen to theirs. And we are grateful that you took time to be with us today.
Glad to be with you. It's been a great conversation. I wish you all the best and blessings on those who will hear and get to benefit the fruit of your labor in this podcast.
Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. Friends, we hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stephen Lewis as much as we did. Amy, what are you taking away from today's conversation?
I am even more amazed at how God has called and gifted Stephen and how we could have continued talking with him for much longer. But every response that he gave to our questions that we had prepared, perhaps anticipating more specific answers, it seemed as though he has such an art for zooming out and weaving in responses inspired by scripture and by his experiences with the Spirit and those that form his community. And it left me seeking more of God and of the Word and how his experiences just bring scripture to life. And it really encouraged me to wonder more about what God is doing and God is seeking to do within us. And so often I have my head down and looking at specific to-do lists and people to work with and just really encouraged me to consider vocational discernment as a spiritual practice of standing back and looking up and just being aware of God's presence. And really, as with a few of our guests, just inspires me more and more to be in my Bible and to see how God's word is speaking to us today. What are you taking away?
I was struck by his emphasis on deep listening. I feel like deep listening is something that he was saying that we struggle with in our modern society, especially when there are so many things in our world that are vying for our attention. We're also not taught, and we don't know, or it may not come naturally, for how we're supposed to do deep listening. Listen for that, the divine voice speaking from within. And it also struck me that as we were talking, that churches don't do a lot of this work. Churches, we need teachers and mentors to teach us how to do that deep listening. And we're often, we know how to have potlucks, and we know how to have good worship services, and we know how to do fun Bible studies and things like that. But so often we don't feel equipped in the church, or we're just not teaching people how to do that kind of deep listening work within ourselves. Mentors identify gifts within us, can affirm those gifts, can help us talk through what our passions are. But mentors, I think he was saying, can also teach us how to do that deep listening work, because we may come to recognize our gifts, but not necessarily know what that calling is or what we're feeling pulled to. And so I was just struck by how that's a real need in our noisy world, when there's so many things in our lives, in our homes, in our workplaces, in our schools, on our phones, on our computers, that are just so many things that are vying for our attention, that it can be a real challenge to be intentional and to learn how to do that deep listening work.
Yeah, it's almost like we have to rely on something external, like the internet going down, to hold away from TV or from our apps on the phone, to actually be present to others or even just present to ourselves. And it's hard to be disciplined to do that on a regular basis.
Well, friends, thank you for joining us on this episode of On Call. Join us next time. And speaking of next time, we'll be taking a break during the winter. We're going to be planning for the spring of next year and interviews and who we're going to have on, and try to reflect and do some deep listening ourselves on how this season has gone. And so if you have any feedback for us on the podcast, if you've enjoyed the podcast, we invite you to rate our podcast, and which helps get the word out, and give us feedback. What do you really think? This will help us plan in the future. We'll see you in the spring.